Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? I'd be doing great if you considered supporting the show today, because conversations like you're about to hear do not happen without support. One of the best ways to support In Defense of Plants is to become a patron over at patreon.com/indefenseofplants. There's a link in every one of the show notes at indefenseofplants.com, but signing up as a patron, you're going to give a little bit of support each month and get a bunch of cool kickbacks in return, including access to bonus episodes. So go consider supporting the show today. But speaking of today, I have such a treat for you, because we are joined by Dr. Ian Glasspool, who studies wildfire history in deep time, and his mechanisms for doing so will blow your mind. Also, when you think of the resolution he's able to get to not only describe snapshots in deep, deep time, but also stories of how ecosystems burn and recover across untold millions of years, is absolutely remarkable. He does this with some really interesting techniques, and I can't wait for you to hear about them. So let's just jump right into it. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Ian Glasspool. I hope you enjoy. All right, Dr. Ian Glasspool, it is so exciting to have you on the podcast today. For those that aren't familiar with your work, let's start off with an introduction. Tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Okay, thanks very much, Matt. I will tell you the convoluted history that is my travels to where I am now.
Ooh.
Believe it or not, I actually started off life as a biochemist from King's College London. And one of the things actually that I find quite interesting was, as a student, they were pointed out Rosalind Franklin's lab from the Watson and Crick DNA experiments.
Wow.
And I never thought I would be citing her research as a geologist, but she worked on coals. And so I'm happy to drag Rosalind Franklin in as one of my references that I can bring up.
That's amazing.
When talking about the origin of coals. So from King's, I had a variety of summer jobs and decided that I wanted to be an engineering geologist. And so done my BSc in biochemistry. I then literally on a motorway service station phoned up Cardiff University and said, I want to come and do a geology degree. Will you let me? Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So, you know, that was it. It was literally on a whim. And I ended up going to Cardiff. I intended to study engineering geology, which I'd fallen in love with, many of the aspects of that. And instead, I turned up some micropaleontology lectures. And that changed the whole course of everything. From that point, I applied for a PhD working on that micro paleontology aspect. But I know you've had a bad day when your girlfriend beats you to the PhD.
Oops.
So I ended up working at Royal Holloway University of London with Professor Andrew Scott on South African coals, or that was the plan originally. I got to admit, I had an interesting PhD experience in that when I arrived at Holloway, I was told I would be working on Southern African coals. We weren't sure which country yet. And so get ready, you're going to South Africa, but you could be going to Botswana or, you know, maybe Zambia, and we don't know. And so I flew out to South Africa for a short course in Johannesburg and discovered that actually I was going to be working in the Witbank coalfield in South Africa, which was an interesting experience, let's put it that way. Anyway, so I started working in the Witbank coalfield, which is deep mines. And the mine there, Kutala, that I worked at, employed about 500 people during a shift. And they had the largest elevators I've ever seen. You could literally drive a truck in there. And people did.
Wow.
And so that was the whole shift would go down at once. Then I'd pick up a set of step ladders, my geological hammers, and walk 2 miles to try and sample coal seams all underground. Sometimes, occasionally, the mine was all stone dusted. So rather than black, you expect a coal mine to be black. You don't expect it to be white. Huh. And there was sheeting in places, drapes. Well, this is all to prevent methane. So they've got methane seeps. And so the stone dust is to reduce the methane seeps to keep it a little safer to be working down there.
Huh.
The parts they were no longer working, they would seal off with heavy curtains. And there was no lighting in there at all. So it was literally just a headlamp. And we would go in there to look for some of the more elevated topography so that I could look at how these coals changed. So you were literally a mile off in this coal mine behind a huge curtain that no one was going to come and look for you for years. And so that was interesting in itself.
Yeah.
Sampling was, a lot of it was up the top of a 9-foot ladder to try and hack huge lumps of coal out of the wall. And you realize at this point, as you're whacking your chisel with a sledgehammer and sparks are flying off, there's a reason they stone dusted this place.
Okay.
And so you're thinking, am I going to get out of here? The first thing to say, yes, I did make it out. Unfortunately, none of my samples made it out.
Oh, no.
Because the miners were fascinated to know what anyone was doing with blocks of coal wrapped in tin foil. So they unwrapped them all see what it was. There had to be something better in there. So I had all these beautifully oriented blocks that I could piece together in a jigsaw puzzle, and they were all unwrapped. So that was a month's work. And I had to redo the lot. So that was, sampling and working in South Africa. Once I'd done that, I thought, I'm on the home stretch. Alas, at this point, we had an argument with the coal company because they would not allow me to present any of my data to an external examiner. Off I trod back to England, leaving my half a ton of coal in South Africa. And I went to work on megaspores from the Moscow Basin instead.
Shift, pivot.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm doing transmission electron microscopy as opposed to coal petrology. So I told you it was convoluted.
Yeah.
I then ended up receiving samples from Australia, and my first publications were actually on Australian coal before almost 2 years later, I got my South African material.
Wow.
And at that point, with our 9-foot coal seam, 3 meters, I sat there and tediously point counted over 59,000 points up through this coal seam to plot how the content changed on a very submillimetric basis.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So it turns out that these coals are chock full of charcoal, and it gives them quite different burning properties. And so if you're actually designing a power station, you have to design it differently if your coal is a North American carboniferous coal to if it's a South African Permian coal with lots of this charcoal in it.
Wow.
And because it doesn't burn as efficiently, it takes longer to ignite. And so it was termed inertinite. And when you see it in petrographic section, that's what it's referred to, is inertinite. I argue that inertinite is a synonym, a direct synonym for charcoal. And that's caused some consternation in the coal petrology world because it interferes with people's nice, simple models where they can plug in X and Y. But I've yet to come up with any other explanation of how you can generate something that looks and behaves like charcoal, yet isn't. Microbial activity and fungal activity, I don't think, normally generate charcoal, which have been some of the popular arguments. So I study coal in polished sections to look at the charcoal within it. And if you take your coal and imagine it was a rock, when you were looking at your rock, you'd be looking at it in terms of minerals. So vitrinite, inertinite, and liptonite. One was sort of gelified plant matter. The other was cuticles, liptonites, spores, algal masses, that sort of thing, okay. Resins. And lastly, there was inertinites. And so all of this started, is inertinite separate from coal? Because you only ever call it inertinite if you see it in a petrographic section. If you macerate it, it's then charcoal.
Interesting.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah, that is a wild world you fell into, quite literally. I mean, through, like you said, a convoluted route. And kudos to you at the end of the day for being open-minded, right? I think that's one of the big takeaways here is that you kind of rolled with it, and here you are with a really fascinating world of research in front of you.
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree more. Once I got into the world of charcoal, it got even more exciting. It really became quite exciting.
Sure.
In that fires have a huge impact on deep time. So you're not just looking at the fire event itself. It actually impacts on everything from the local geography. You know, you can wipe out a forest and change the sedimentology because you've no longer got the trees intercepting the rainfall. So you get much more runoff and erosion. So you change the nature of the environment. Charcoal as well, it turns out, has huge feedbacks into things like the carbon cycle and the oxygen cycle. And so if when you're modeling these things, you don't take wildfire into consideration, your models tend to be rather skewy. And so charcoal is suddenly now becoming much more of a hot topic, not just because of the wildfires we experience in the modern world, but also what it can tell us or how we can use it to model deep time more accurately.
Right.
That's fascinating.
That is amazing to think about, because what you're really measuring are these snapshots in deep time, which when you think about it in that context, it gives me goosebumps every time because, you know, these are events. I mean, mind you, they could have lasted for a very long time in our timeline. But when you think of the time periods you're dealing with, to be able to say, hey, there was something here, this indicates X, Y, and Z. You really are learning about the ecology. And that was, talking with your colleague a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Gastaldo, about putting things into context. This is the kind of context that, I mean, really just blows up our ability to understand ancient ecologies because the players were different, but like physics and chemistry is still the same. So what was happening and how do we use that to understand today? Last year, 300 something million years ago.
Oh, yeah. You know, 300 million years it's a mind-boggling time scale. And it's only when you try and illustrate it to kids in a classroom that you realize the difficulty of putting humans on a time scale with the planet Earth. It really looks ridiculous. Everything is jammed into the last microsecond. If you were to do it on the clock face. And so, as you say, we're looking at snapshots. And that's something I try and keep very much in mind with my work, is that all of these charcoal records are just a snapshot at a particular window in time. I tried to accumulate enough data, a bulk data analysis, to try and predict... use charcoal to have a look at atmospheric oxygen concentrations. In other words, when fires burn, they need three things. They need a source of fuel, they need a source of ignition, and they need oxygen. And so we tried to eliminate the first two as much as possible. Lightning is the main source of wildfires.
Sure.
I think there's about 44, 45 strikes per second somewhere across the globe.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's reasonable to assume that this hasn't changed much, or that there's always been some readily available source of ignition
right.
Through time. We have fulgurites, in the fossil record, which literally lightning has struck sandstone or sands and melted it. And so, you know, you literally have a fossil lightning strike.
Cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'd eliminated lightning. That's likely to have been a steady state. Climate plays a huge role in fires. You know, this is part of the problem I have with talking to modern fire ecologists, in that there are so many unknowns in the work that, you know, I'm doing, because the material's up to 430 million years old and has been transported.
Yeah.
You know, most of it, you know, if you're lucky, you can go into a carboniferous coal swamp and find these, coal balls. This is a particular bête noire of mine. How on earth can you get anyone excited about science if you call something a coal ball? It's so awful. These things are perfectly permineralized peats. So that when you look at them, you can take thin sections or peels of them. You can see cellular level detail of the plants that were there.
Yeah,
this is fantastic. It's like doing a fossil CAT scan. You take hundreds of these peels through these plants to work down through them. And so you can find in these coal balls examples of plants that have charred, and you can actually see they look different even in these coal balls from the other material. They have this black appearance, whereas the non-coalified material is actually brown, or more of a brown color. Interestingly enough, if you pick up a lump of coal, if you've got a nice cuticle-rich coal or a nice vitrinite-rich coal, you're going to stay fairly clean. If, however, you've picked up a lump of South African coal full of charcoal, that's when you're going to get smutty and all the what we traditionally think of with coal.
Wow.
And so a lot of it comes from the actual charcoal, the inertinite in the coal.
I mean, quite literally, it looks like you've been playing in a charcoal grill.
Yes. After the experience in South Africa, I took a photograph of myself in a mirror in all my mining gear and sent it back to my parents. And they asked me, who was this guy? it was pretty horrific, in all honesty. Silicosis, and, you know, miners, I feel for them.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wild, nasty world. And, you know, especially you go back only a few decades, it's even worse. But, you know, thinking about what you're looking at and the kind of things you have to be able to discern in a sample, I mean, I'm already, you know, again, surface level understanding of this stuff, having grown up in coal country, I just kind of assumed carbon is carbon is carbon when it comes to coal. So you've already mentioned there's different types depending on what parts of the plant or how it was preserved. But how are you discerning, you know, you mentioned sort of getting your hands dirty, but you're probably dealing with some tiny stuff, little samples at times. What are you looking for when you, okay, I've got charcoal or inertinite, whatever we're going to call it for this episode.
Yeah. Let's start off if I've got a lump of coal. And you can have coal of various different sorts. You could start off with a peat. And if you compress it, bury it under 500 meters of rock, you'll end up with something called lignite. You've driven off some of the gas, some of the water, and you've got this brown, still fairly soft, more carbon-rich coal, this lignite. Compress it again, maybe down to 1,000 meters, you drive off yet more of the volatiles, more of the hydrogen, more of the oxygen, more of the water, and you end up with what's a bituminous coal, which we use for making coke for the steel industry and things like this. And eventually, when you've driven enough of the gases off, you get to anthracite at the very top end, and that's the most carbon-rich of the coals. In many ways, it's easier to separate out charcoal from your peats, your lignites, and even your bituminous coals. Once you get up to anthracite, it's a whole different ballpark. And I haven't worked on many things in that. What I've just described is termed rank. And so it's rank maturation, and it relates to the burial pressure, the burial time, and to a lesser degree, temperature. Hydrothermal activity will affect this coalification process. So I go hack my chunk of coal out of my coal mine very carefully so that it's nicely oriented. Even I will put it in a plaster jacket, like someone's leg, because I don't want it to splinter and fall apart.
Nice.
So I treat it with TLC, and then I will, as best I can, cut that coal, keeping it intact on a large circular saw, then embed it in resin. And once it's embedded in resin, then I can look through it petrographically. And that's where you're talking about the microscopic constituents.
Okay.
And that's where I see the really small stuff. The other half of that seam, that piece of coal that I cut away, that you can macerate. So typically you macerate chew up, chew up with acid. In this case, most coals you'll macerate with nitric acid. And everything breaks down within there. If you macerate too much, you're going to destroy all of the spores, the cuticles, etc. you'd like to get out of the coal. The inertinite, the charcoal, is a bit more resistant. It's one of the clues that we're looking at charcoal, which is quite nice. However, there's charcoal and there's almost charcoal.
Okay.
So you don't just start off with something that's not charcoal. If you think about a tree, a metasequoia that's experiencing a nice fire, and the external trunk gets charred, the internal trunk is not charred. And so there's a gradual transition from charred to uncharred. And you can actually follow that petrographically. But the only slightly charred coal reacts quite differently to the fully carbonized charcoalified material.
Wow.
And so it's much more susceptible to oxidation and, you know, nitric acid maceration. So play around with that. If, however, I start off with a nice sandstone or siltstone, then you start playing around with the fun stuff. So you throw it into hydrochloric acid, first of all, just a puny old 37%, to make sure you've got rid of any carbonates. Because if you don't get rid of the carbonates and then you dump a large portion of hydrofluoric acid on your rock sample, it's going to react very vigorously indeed and quite exothermically.
Oh, no.
One of the problems with hydrofluoric acid is it's used to etch glass. So you can't put your samples in glass beakers.
Ooh.
They have to go into polypropylene because nitrile or anything else they'll just literally dissolve through. And so if your reaction gets too hot, even if it doesn't effervesce over the top, you end up with a nice melted pot of sludge. And no one wants to go near your fume hood because hydrofluoric acid is one of the least desirable chemicals I've ever worked with.
Yeah.
It has a bad reputation.
Fun. Okay.
So you put it through hydrofluoric acid, then you neutralize it. Always important, definitely neutralize it, because when you're poking around with it with your fingers, you don't want hydrofluoric acid burns.
The joys of the job.
Yeah, and then sometimes the material's ready to examine by with the dissecting microscope. Normally that's what I would do first, is I get a slurry of material and I'll put it under a dissecting microscope. And typically, I'll look for an array of material. I'll pick out the goodies that you see. Oh, that's branching. Oh, that's something really interesting. And I'll pick out some of those. Then I'll pick out a broader spectrum of material from that to try and eliminate some of the bias. Then I will take just a random sample, grab sample, and I will just embed that so I can look at everything, so that I'm skewing my sampling as little as possible, because of course I want to look at all the beautifully charred material where everything's preserved. You know, that seems sort of counterindicatory, that charcoal is the reason we have some of the most spectacular plant fossils, you know, that are around there. Many of the earliest angiosperms, the flowering structures, are preserved as charcoal. It's fantastic. So many of the early land plants from the Welsh borderlands, we're talking millimetric size plants, a Lilliputian flora, it's been referred to as. You know, these things, you don't just see the outside form. You can crack them open and see the internal anatomy. You can see, again, cellular and even subcellular level structures.
Wow.
That, to me, is remarkable. You can see where the fire may have blistered the cuticle on the outside of this before the whole thing was charred. But you end up with this beautiful, brittle fossil. That's the one problem, is that it's relatively brittle.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to put a kilometer's worth of rock on top of it, you can tend to compress it just a little. Well, you don't compress it. You cause it to shatter.
Oh.
And so the Germans have a term called Bogenstruktur, which are these. So you'd start off with a cell that's literally sheared, and the walls have gone into the lumen of the cell because they're sort of brittle. And that's, you see, it just looks like someone's gone crazy on a mirror with a hammer, and there's just thousands of little pieces everywhere.
So, and then you get a grad student to put them back together.
Oh, absolutely. Grad students are wonderful. And no, that's one of the best things, because there is a lot of tedium, as you may have guessed from the 59,000 point counts.
Sure.
But that's what generates, you know, the meaningful data.
Yeah.
I think it's phenomenally exciting to be able to look back at, say, Permian period, to look and see a wildfire event where you had originally glossopteran trees and abundant lycopods. This fire event goes through. You've then suddenly got just charcoal everywhere, layers of dirt over the top of it, and then gradually a flora reestablishes itself up above on top of this new setting. You know, the hydrogeology of the environments often change really dramatically by the combustion of the peat.
Right.
And so you're not necessarily going to go straight back to the same floor that you started with. So you can start with one and end up with something completely different. And, you know, it's fun to think that fire is a big component of that.
Yeah.
You know, and you see it again in South African coals. You see these charcoal peaks, then a huge band of mineral matter immediately above it, because the vegetation was killed. Then rainfall and increased runoff and erosion, and you get all this mineral matter suddenly flows into the coal seam,
wow.
Which, if you're a power station operator, you will curse because you can't burn mineral matter.
Right.
So it requires extra treatment to try and remove some of that.
I love thinking about that, though, because so much of like what I do as a modern day plant person is go out and look at the context of, okay, why are these plants here? Okay, they like or can handle a lot more calcium. Why is there so much calcium here? Oh, they're sitting on top of a reef. How old is it? So it's like many millions of years in the past is still influencing the future today, modern day. And here you are. It's different versions of that story, and maybe it's annoying the heck out of a mining operation or someone that runs a coal plant, but like these are snapshots stacked on snapshots stacked on snapshots, so that you, the scientist, get to be able to put enough of those snapshots together and tell the story, but then put in all the context of hundreds of millions of years in the future, the frustrations of individuals and companies. Like, that is so mind-blowing that what you're doing on both a macro and microscopic scale gives us past, present, and potentially predictive power in the future.
Oh, yes, I believe so. And I think that's one of the interesting things about charcoal, is it does offer some valuable insights into maybe how our vegetation is going to change with climate change. I worked on a section through East Greenland at the Triassic-Jurassic boundary. And as the climate warmed there, the CO2 rose pretty dramatically to several thousand parts per million, though at a much slower rate than we're doing it today.
Right.
There was massive floral turnover. And you start to see plants with more dissected leaves. So they have a larger surface area. So they're immediately more flammable. And so you've warmed your climate. You now have all these plants with a more dissected, or at least in the Triassic and the Jurassic, morphology, and they're more susceptible to burning. And, you know, it's, so you do see that peak in fire activity following this transition before the original vegetation starts to reestablish itself again.
Wow.
In that setting. So, you know, that I think is fun. You've talked about masses of data. And I've talked a lot about coal. I'm sure you weren't expecting that.
Please, but
one of the great things, well, probably the only great thing about the coal industry at the moment is the fact that they generate huge amounts of data. And you can mine this data to look at the coal quality. And so you can have huge volumes of data on charcoal from all these coals from throughout the world. And so you're reducing the amount to which you're just relying on one point in time when you start being arm wavy and make generalizations about maybe atmospheric oxygen was higher at this time, because we've got so many hundreds of seams worth of data and tens of thousands worth of points of data that show us that during these intervals, it's statistically significant that there's more charcoal.
Right. That is a really interesting perspective, because one of the big questions I had for you is, how do you get enough data? Because, you know, your lab, whatever, your colleagues can only do so much effort. But I guess by identifying them in the bits you get to look at, you get to extrapolate across, like you said, the entire coal mining industry's need for high detailed stratigraphic, or whatever you want to call it, resolution for what they do as an industry. And that, to me, you know, any one event in deep time is hard to find. Fossilization, extremely hard to find, but extrapolated across, that's actually pretty remarkable to think of what you do have available because of this industry, from a data perspective.
Suddenly a huge data resource at you. It took quite a time to compile it all.
Sure.
But, you know, then I at least feel there's some more robustness, certainly in certain areas. Some areas are less robust. There's a lot of question about the timing of onset of modern levels of atmospheric oxygen. Sometime in the Paleozoic, levels jumped up to more modern levels, but when exactly did that happen? There are different geochemical proxies that give slightly different answers to that question. In terms of charcoal, I've gone on a hunt for charcoal from this sort of interval. The earliest charcoal I've yet found is about 430 million years old.
Wow.
And at that point, the things that were being charred were this very enigmatic group called nematophytes. And one of those, I don't know if you might have heard of Prototaxites. It is a giant phallic fungus that's up to about 26 feet tall and, you know, 3 feet wide.
Wild.
And it can be. Though it can also be at the other extreme. You can find millimetric-sized specimens of this. But that's what we're finding charred 430 million years ago.
Wow.
Which I think is pretty cool in itself. And we can take some of this charcoal and look at it under my reflected light microscope, and you can measure how much light. It seems really counterintuitive that you've got black charcoal, and what am I trying to do is bounce light off it. But when you look at coal, or charcoal, I should say, in reflected light, if it's been charred to a very high temperature, you'll see it shine a brilliant gold color. So you'll work your way up through the silvers to the golds, and you'll get really high reflectance. In other words, your material is sufficiently well organized that it's reflecting the light back. And from that, we've done experimental charring work. And so we can use that to estimate what temperatures we were looking at in some of these fires from 430 million years ago based on modern material.
Wow.
There's a problem there that I'm sure you will point out to me very rapidly, in that most of these things are rather enigmatic. So how do we know what they were? Most of the experimental charring is done on woods. And that's not very helpful if you're looking at something that has a fungal anatomy.
Right.
And so we've also, my colleague and I, Andrew Scott, charred things like Ganoderma, bracket fungus, and measured the reflectance on that. And it tracks pretty closely with the other wood. There's a slight offset. And if I think that the material is fungal in nature, then I will use that calibration curve rather than a more plant-derived calibration curve.
I love the idea that even after a catastrophic wildfire and millions of years going through the geologic processes of Earth, you know, the charring process preserves that kind of detail to give you that kind of resolution. Yeah. What is it about the charring process that can preserve such fine scale structure? I mean, when I look at my fireplace or the remnants of a bonfire, I'm not picking out what kind of stuff I was burning other than plant.
So this all comes down to pyrolysis. In other words, heating something in an environment that's starved of oxygen. And so the original charring experiments, many of them that were done, were a little less refined than they should have been. And so at higher temperature, that was polite, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was good. Well done.
Good. So at higher temperatures, you'd start to get the ingress of some oxygen. And then you'd rapidly see these tissues break down, decay, and turn into ash. The lower temperature stuff was not problematic. You know, stuff above 250 degrees to about 500, you were getting nice charcoal. But up about 600, you'd start to see one of the things when you char wood and you look at it in reflected light is you can no longer discern a middle lamella between the cells. And it's cell wall homogenization is what we call it. And it was always thought that it reappeared at about 600 degrees. We found out differently, Andrew and I, when we were working on Montserrat. We weren't actually working on fossil material there. It was an active volcanic eruption in Plymouth. And these pyroclastic flows were rolling down the mountain or the volcano, really hot. One thing we found is that you can, rather than try and prod away at these pyroclastic flows that are 600 degrees or whatever and try and measure them while they're still hot, not a fun experience.
No.
You can wait for them to cool down and look at the charcoal. And you can then take the charcoal, because the ash excludes all the air wonderfully. There were things like entire charred telegraph poles.
Wow.
Literally just entire telegraph poles preserved as charcoal. And you start to look at the reflectance of these things, because they've been held at 600 degrees or more for weeks, months, really long duration. So this whole thing is charred all the way through, but you no longer see this cell wall homogenization. So a lot of the preservation that we're getting is this pyrolytic effect, where you're excluding oxygen, then you're just removing the volatiles and the water from your material. If you were to pick out some of the charcoal from your fire, not the ashy stuff, providing you've not got briquettes, you could, you know, if you're using real lump hardwood, you could look at that and you will see cellular level anatomy.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
So I just have to try harder, is what you're saying. Crawl around my bonfire pit.
Yeah, just don't use briquettes and don't take the ashy stuff. And
deal.
You know. Yep.
Okay. So you have all of this work underneath you, you've access to data sets that I never would imagine could exist. I mean, what kind of stories are you able to put together from multiple snapshots across the globe? Because not every area you're working in is the same time period, the same age. No. I mean, are you at that point in this field where you can start to say wildfire frequencies have changed over the time? Like, what kind of stories can you tell with the stuff you've seen?
Now, that's a very interesting question. As you said, I have worked up and down the column from the tertiary or the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum all the way down into the mid-Silurian. And yes, you do see changes on broad sweeping timescales. Mm-hmm. It's like certain hothouse intervals. The Cretaceous is really classic for this. The start of the Cretaceous, there's comparatively little charcoal to be found. But then as climate heats up, also coincidentally, as you start to see more angiosperms, charcoal is, boom, everywhere. It's really phenomenally abundant. But extrapolating too much, again, from point records, it's difficult to make. I wouldn't want to make too many huge sweeping statements.
Sure, sure.
But you can use it to get a picture of this time period was much more fire prone. And therefore, we're probably on the geological timescales that we're talking about, ending up with more recalcitrant charcoal buried and removed from the carbon cycle. And so this has long-term effects on the carbon cycle and on the oxygen cycle as well. So in that respect, charcoal, as I said earlier, plays this balancing role in modeling of ecosystems and climates and atmospheric compositions. And I think there's a lot of exciting work to be done, more work to be done there. Also, there is the perturbation that wildfire introduces into a setting.
Right.
And again, as I talked about earlier, the floral turnover that can result with it. Unfortunately, again, it's this is one case, here's another case. And, you know, extrapolating, the floras change really quite dramatically, as you know. So big picture, I would want to take care.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes sense. Again, you're dealing with such wide spans of time and space, really. I mean, the other part of it, too, is just think of how drastically different the continents were in many of these time periods, right? I mean, what these ecosystems were doing, how they were influencing the climate as, you know, functioning ecosystems, and then what does that look like after a fire burns through? How far could a wildfire burn when you don't have teams of people trying to put it out or cities getting in the middle of, you know, creating an asphalt fire break? I mean, it's such a wildly different time period, no matter where you're looking, that I'm sure context is everything in trying to piece these stories together.
You know, there's some fun ones that Shallowy in Ireland from the early Carboniferous. There was so much charcoal dumped into the estuary then that you ended up with mass fish mortality.
Wow.
And, you know, so that is, you were talking there about a huge fire of hundreds of kilometers, and the volume of charcoal that it dumped in was massive. You know, then there's other nice stories such as Joggins, which is another Carboniferous locality in Canada, eastern Canada. And there you find these charred or these lycopod stumps with charcoal in the center of them and little vertebrates that look as though they were seeking shelter from fires and got toasted alive. Oh. It's kind of sad.
Yeah. But again, there's these moments in history, and that is so wild to think about the odds that are so, so stacked against it. Yeah. Yet it does happen. You just have to know where to look. But you stack enough of those on top, you're getting that sort of longer term perspective out of these. It just, again, I can't tell you how phenomenal that is for someone that just grew up obsessed with paleontology and the amount of forensic detail that goes into trying to analyze what you do on a day-to-day basis. But the stories that come out of it are just so cool.
One of the ones that always the press get very excited about is dinosaurs plus charcoal. And I've worked on two of these. Everyone wants to see a flaming dinosaur running across the landscape. There's yet to be any solid proof that any of these dinosaurs were killed by these fire events, but the fires may have played a large part in transporting and preserving the skeletons. So they may also have resulted in ecological instability that would have made it hard for dinosaurs to thrive in a particular area. So while we don't necessarily have T-Rex flaming, you know, across the landscape, we certainly know that wildfires impacted these vertebrates, and also that they impacted them in a way that enables us to collect them more easily today,
right,
because they were, you know, buried as a result of some of the erosion related to the fire.
Right. Yeah. I think of how many fossil accounts I follow, and they said, you know, this was laid down during a mudslide or a landslide, you know, moments you got to, what caused it? Oh, maybe it was the entire vegetation burning away because of a catastrophic wildfire.
Well, that's exactly it. And I think there are a lot of geologists now who are starting to look at how wildfires may have impacted the geological record far more than they'd previously thought to be the case. And I think it's far more on people's minds that you can have mass sedimentary events resulting from wildfires. You know, one coal I worked on in Australia is 35 meters. It's over 100 feet thick, and it's 70% charcoal.
Whoa.
I still don't understand how that happened. And, you know, if anyone has a, you know, you see, if you go to Colorado and you see these immense wildfires up in the Rockies, and then you'll see often rivers that are running black with masses of charcoal. And there were photographs of backhoes digging out feet of charcoal that have been deposited following some of these wildfire events. And I like to think that's what maybe this Blair Athol coal in Australia is. It's multiple fire events. But even that, it's still 100 feet of charcoal. And, you know, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, or like, I think of like what's going on in places like Indonesia, where you do have modern day peat swamps that burn. You know, could that have been just burning slowly down in a lower and lower oxygen environment kind of thing?
I mean,
hundreds of feet, though, that's wild.
Yes. Oh, it is. It's absolutely incredible. Those peat fires in Indonesia, they're chucking a huge amount of carbon up into the atmosphere in terms of wildfires. The only thing that's really chucking up more are agricultural fires. The least polluting are your nice savanna fires. They get off fairly lightly.
Yeah.
But yeah, the peat fires are awful polluters.
Right. And I mean, speaking of that, you think of climate change. It can't be lost on you as a scientist that, you know, what you're looking at in the past, the industry that has provided so much of the material is creating a future where you go, hey, well, that's happened before, but we're doing it way quicker now, thanks in part to y'all.
Yeah. Well, at the current rates of extraction, I believe there is enough coal for another 133 years.
Oof.
Yeah, exactly. The big coal producers of the US has about a quarter of the world's reserves. There's Russia, China, Australia, and those have very significant, India, significant quantities of coal. So,
yeah. You have to think of these things, right?
And, you know, I hope that what I do throws some light onto it. You know, I hope too that I'm not proud enough that I can't look back at my work and go, you know, that wasn't quite right. Let me reevaluate this. And I'm, well, in the process of doing that at the moment.
Okay.
There was something I named the Charcoal Gap, which was this Devonian time interval where there was just relatively little charcoal. And we're starting to see the first trees. Wattiesa, Spermatopteris, that you talked to Chris Berry about, before they're growing on into Archaeopteryx, a much more woody vegetation.
Mm.
But until the Archaeopteryx are really well established, there's a whole paucity of charcoal there, or we thought there was. But it depends on what records you look at.
Ah.
And so that's currently one of the things that I'm working on is going back and looking at what other new sources of data can we throw at this to try and reevaluate that picture and see if we were right.
Very exciting stuff. And so with that in mind, if people want to keep a finger on the pulse of your work, past, present, and future, where do you recommend they go looking to find out more?
So there are many wonderful authors on wildfire out there. Pine, Andrew Scott, they have some fantastic and very easily approachable books that send you in all the right directions for your fire research. There's a lot of ecological work in those as well. So it's not all just deep time. It does extend on into the present as well. And so I think it gives a more holistic picture of the history of fire. That's where I would head to look.
Excellent. I will spice it up for you, throw in your Google Scholar or ResearchGate profile as well so people can read your work. But
please.
Dr. Glasspool, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe what you get to look at and what stories you get to tell with your work. And thank you so much for taking time to tell us your stories about it and how you got there. It was phenomenal.
Thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure.
Excellent. Well, in the meantime, keep in touch, and you're welcome back on to discuss more wildfire data as it's coming in. Maybe those gaps will shrink even more.
Ah, can but hope. Excellent. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.
All right. How amazing was that? The resolution he and his colleagues are able to get, both in snapshots in time, but also across the history of these ecosystems, is amazing. And I can't thank him enough for taking time out of his busy schedule to talk with us. As always, I put up all of the relevant links in the show notes over at indefensiveplants.com so you can learn more following each one of these conversations. While you're over there, look at all the different ways you can help support the show, because conversations like this can't happen without support. As I mentioned at the beginning, you can become a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants, or you can pick up a copy of my book, some of our customizable merch and stickers, and all of those links are in the show notes at indefensiveplants.com as well. I thank you all for listening. Make sure you hit that subscribe button and keep checking back in. But until next time, hang in there, stay healthy, and get outside if you can. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.